Welcome to the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward, a podcast looking at legislation as it passes through Oireachtas Éire in our National Parliament.
Okay, you're very welcome to the fifth episode of the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. And this evening we're going to talk about Seanad reform. And this is not a new subject. There have been 14 reports on Seanad reform since 1928. But what's interesting is that at the moment there are actually two private members' bills before the Oireachtas, both of them launched in the Seanad, dealing with Seanad reform. And I'm delighted to be joined this evening by the sponsors of one of those bills, Senator Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil from Wexford, who sponsored the Seanad Electoral University Members Amendment Bill 2020, and by the Chancellor of the National University of Ireland and a former leader of Seanad Éireann, Dr. Maurice Manning, who was also the author of one of the seminal reports on Seanad reform in 2013, I think. Maurice, is that right?
15,
I beg your pardon, and I'm thinking of the referendum. So, Maurice, I might start with you, if that's okay. You were obviously a long time member of Seanad Éireann, elected into one of the panel positions. Can you give us just a broad overview of the history of reform of the Seanad, or what your view on it is at this stage?
Well, look, it's been around forever. And when De Valera was devising the new constitution in 1937, he did say, well, A bad Senate is better than no Senate. He actually said that on the record. And he was very determined that the Senate would never be in a position to challenge the Dáil. And in democratic theory, he was right. The old Free State Senate had become a thorn in the side of the government. All governments are the same. They resent, they're in a hurry. Their legislation has to get through quickly. The people who drew it up knew everything about it that's there. So that never changes. And in fact, the Cumann na n-Éill Party was just as impatient of the old Senate. But the old Senate was there for a purpose, which was to give representation to the unionist minority, which was quite sizable. And in the sensitivities of the time, it was a good idea. But secondly, that Senate did supply a sort of bits of expertise, not too much, that maybe the Dáil lacked. But anyway, I could go on forever on this. I won't. That the people decided in the referendum that they were going to keep the Senate.
Even before that, Maurice, I mean, I remember Mary O'Rourke chaired a review in, I think, 2003. And at that point, everything was on the table except abolition. So there hasn't ever really been a political will to abolish the Seanad until Enda Kenny announced that he was going to hold that referendum in, I think he announced that in 2013. And then subsequently, the referendum was defeated, the referendum took place in 2013 and was defeated by a narrow margin in favour of retaining the Seanad. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I'll be brief on this. When that happened, it was clear that there was no enthusiasm for the Seanad. And people who voted for its retention said, yes, but it has to be reformed. Mm-hmm. The problem when the Taoiseach asked me to chair a committee on reform of the Seanad about 2014 or thereabouts, there was a central problem. The people had voted to keep the Seanad. The Seanad was defined by the Constitution, often in very intrusive detail and fussy detail. So any reforms had to be within the Constitution. And so the document which we produced was curtailed by that. We would have probably gone for a very different Seanad afterwards. So we tried to address a few fundamental principles. The most basic one was that the Seanad is fundamentally undemocratic. It excludes 98% of the population from having any say in who should be in it. And that's, in a republic, really an affront to democracy in many ways. So that's why we tried to establish in our report the principle of one person, one vote. We had to do it in complicated ways. We had to retain the whole corporate structure which is laid down in the Constitution. And we tried to expand that in a way which would allow everybody have a choice and vote. I mean, Michael McDougall's bill is very largely based on that report. And But clearly, I'm encouraged by the fact that there is some interest in it still, that the Seanad itself has taken the lead. I think Fianna Fáil are open to Shannon reform. I don't think Fine Gael gives a damn, and most of the people who were involved in the process in Fine Gael in the last Shannon were being two-faced, is a polite word for it. They were saying they were all for it, but they did everything in their power to frustrate it. So I'm glad it's on the agenda again, and maybe we could discuss the subject we're talking about.
Well, you mentioned Michael McDougall's bill there. So Michael McDougall, along with Senators Gerard Crockwell and Alice Mary Higgins, have published a bill as well, which is called the Shannon Bill 2020. And it is, without any disrespect to you, Malcolm, a weighty tome and a much more comprehensive document. I think it runs to nearly 100 sections, and there's a number of schedules as well. And Maurice, you're saying it implements a number of the reforms that were suggested in your report, isn't that right?
Its intention was to use the report as its template and try to translate that into legislation.
Yeah. Can I challenge just one thing you said there? Because you said that the Shannon was fundamentally undemocratic. As a senator myself, and I don't know whether you remember, but did a paper for you as some manner of dissertation when I was in UCD on this subject. But I've always been a big fan of the Shannon, and I would say not that it's undemocratic, but it's indirectly democratic. Because people do get a say, to an extent, I suppose, through their councillors, but there is an indirect democracy to the Shannon that is unusual and perhaps unsatisfying for the electorate in general, but it's not undemocratic.
I would be a strong supporter, and our report does have provision for a number of seats to be held by people from local governments. And I think that's a good idea, and I think that is defensible. They are themselves elected representatives, but it only goes a bit of the way.
Yeah, I know, accept that. Malcolm, can I turn to you just to talk about your bill? We'd be aware that in 1979, there was a referendum. The Seventh Amendment to the Constitution changed the aspects of Article 18 that restricted the university seats to the NUI and the University of Dublin, or Trinity College, as we would mostly know it. That amendment has never been implemented in legislation, isn't that right?
It's correct. Actually, Barry, just before I talk specifically on the bill, and it's to pick up on one or two points Mars made, and I think there is this question of what is the purpose of the Shannon or the upper chamber? And it was, as Mars said originally, around trying to ensure that unionist voices were represented, that there were diverse voices. Interestingly, there was a direct election to the Shannon in 1925, and it's fascinating to look at it. It was for something like 19 seats. There were 73 candidates on a 73 candidates on a ballot paper, and it operated by PRSTV, the system we use. So while there's complaints in the US at the moment about how long it's taking to count the votes, apparently that 1925 election took the guts of a month. And I recall reading that one of the candidates, I think he was successful, but he pointed out that coverage of the count got far more attention from the media than coverage of the actual campaign itself. Mm-hmm. So there's probably been very little change in that. But my point is that the idea behind the Shannon is not that it exactly replicates the membership of the Dáil. And I think Morris's report and a lot of others said that this is about a second chamber looking in a very different way on legislation and on policy and being reflective and considering what it is that comes before it. And for that reason, the idea was that university graduates would have something to offer and would be able to give a different perspective. So when the 1937 Constitution came about, it provided for six seats to be elected by graduates from the universities. Three at the time, three would come from the University of Dublin, Trinity College, and three from the National University of Ireland. And of course, at that time, the proportion of the population, the proportion of school leavers going on to university education was at about 1% or 2%. I think one of the big changes over the, in Irish society is where we have gone from where participation in higher education was very much an elite activity to one where we now have mass participation. You know, the participation rates of school leavers in higher education now is over 60%. So, you know, there has been that huge change. But in 1979, this was when the referendum happened. And the idea was to extend voting rights to graduates of institutions other than the NUI institutions, which would mean UCD, UCC, UCG, and Maynooth were all part of the NUI at the time, and Trinity. And we were looking at then the new national institutes of higher education were starting to emerge from which became DCU and the University of Limerick. We also had what were the regional technical colleges that became the Institutes of Technology and are now becoming the technological universities. So, you know, we have, the higher education landscape has changed enormously since the 1930s. There was an effort to address this in, I think, the referendum. It was it dealt with both that on the same day, the referendums on that and on adoption law. And I think it has the record as the low referendum.
Right, yep.
The Sixth Amendment was on the Constitution Adoption Act 1979, to which ensured that adoption orders made by the adoption board could not be declared invalid because they were not made by a court. And as you point out, Malcolm, the 3rd of August 1979, I mean, in a modern context, it would be inconceivable to hold a referendum in August like that. Can I ask you about the change that the Shannon referendum, the Seventh Amendment, made to Article 18.4 point 2 of the Constitution, which was to create the right of the Oireachtas to nominate any other institutions of higher education in the state to also be institutions who will qualify to elect people to those six university panel seats. That's how does your bill kind of give vent to that particular provision?
So what I would like to see happen is so we're due to discuss this bill quite soon to move it to second stage in the Shannon, and I'm open to what approach may be the most effective approach to do this. My view is the ideal is that we move to a single 6-seat constituency rather than having these 2 3-seat constituencies, a single 6-seat constituency that is open to the graduates of any recognised higher education institution. So while there's been quite strong campaigns by graduates of the University of Limerick and Dublin City University, to allow graduates of the Institute of Technology and so on to also come on board. My view, and I know a lot of the concern is that it's going to be really difficult to manage, you know, an electoral register, you know, in that regard. And what I've been suggesting is that rather than, you know, Morris and the NUI having to try and manage it and write out to everyone who's ever a graduate, that it becomes an opt-in. But that over time, what will happen is if somebody graduates, they fill in a form to go on the register. But certainly my view, and again, I'm open to the discussion as this legislation goes through, is that we have a single 6-seater that graduates of any recognized institution as determined by the minister, would be entitled.
I think you're right. I mean, you're going to have an electorate potentially. For our NUI Shannon elections, we have an electorate of about 100,000, which is about 30% of those who are eligible to be registered and who aren't. So if you extend it, you've Trinity and all the others, you're looking at an electorate of 300,000 to 400,000, which is as big as a Euro constituency. And you know all about how big that is, but it's big. I think at this stage you should be a bit adventurous and look at the idea of doing voting online, registering online. We recommended that in our report. You might have a look at it. And we... and this is 5 years ago, and technology has improved since then. But we had IBM and we had the Irish National Security people, cyber security people, look at it. And we were, because you were talking also of a lot of graduates who were living in Australia, America, who would like to vote. So I think if you're doing that, Bill, you might look at being a bit adventurous and looking about going online, so where people could register online and vote online. It's possible, and we outlined it in the report. Otherwise, it's going to be, I mean, the Department of Local Government will run like miles from it, and they'll tell whatever minister why it would be unwise to do this.
But Maurice, is that part of the problem from a practical standpoint? Because I remember speaking to a university senator a number of years ago who was able to show me on the register where there were people registered in places like Rhodesia and the USSR in recent years, who, I mean, states that no longer exist. When people are registered living abroad, and it's on the one hand a great opportunity to enfranchise the diaspora, but on the other hand, there's no opportunity really to know if that person passes away, if they change address, unless they actively engage with the registrar of the electors within the NUI or University of Dublin.
It's an impossible job, Barry. Yeah. We have people who are dedicated. That's their job, to keep the register updated and to trace down in the papers deaths and so on, because it's very offensive if a widow or a widower gets a vote for somebody who has died. So it's a big job. We don't have the resources to do it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the practical things involved. Whereas going online, I mean, if people are going to vote, it's not a big deal to ask them to go to the trouble of registering. And then you have an up-to-date register. But I won't go into the detail, but we worked it out in quite some detail. And we did test it with IBM and others. And they reckoned it could be secure.
And Malcolm, does your bill make allowances for that?
Yeah, no, it can operate in that way. I mean, it's interesting what Mara said. There's not just, I mean, the Register of Electors for the university panels for the Shannon is not just the only register that's in trouble. I mean, as we all know, the Register of Electors for general elections has been a difficulty. And I know, I mean, something that's very welcome, the government is now going to fast track establishing an electoral commission that will...
Well, fast track.
Well, yeah. I have to laugh
when you say that.
We do now have a Minister of State with responsibility for electoral reform. So that's some step forward. But
who is that?
That's Malcolm Noonan from the Green Party.
And I think that, I mean, the Taoiseach is very personally committed to this. He wants to see it happen while he is Taoiseach. So I think you're right, though. The question about how we manage and run all of our elections, not just the university panels, is one we need to look at. One of the things I found interesting was there were votes cast in the US presidential election using blockchain technology, where people use their mobile phones to cast their vote. And the technology and the security is now there. I think when we introduced electronic voting in 2002, there was still too much suspicion around the security. People didn't have the trust and confidence in it. I think now, once the technology is there, people will be able to do it. I think it can be transformative. That may also lead, by the way, to greater opportunities for people to engage in direct democracy in participation decision making. I know, Barry, that's not the subject of the podcast.
No, it's okay.
But I do think,
it's an opportunity for the Shannon in a way to test out this online voting and so on, because that's the way we're going. I mean, that is probably 10, 15 years' time. A lot of people, younger people, will wonder why the hell they can't vote online. They can do everything else online. Why can't you vote online? And it could be an interesting initiative for the Senate, for the Shannon, maybe to pioneer that. And from the point of view of an electoral commission, it would allow them to test out what is possible and so on. Because I presume if there is an electoral commission, it will, to an extent, be proactive, rather than just reacting. I don't think there's much point in having it if it isn't. Anyway, keep working with that. I'd love to see it happen.
Yeah. Well, Maurice, can I ask you then, if there were one reform you could make to the Shannon and the way it operates or the way it's elected, what would it be?
I don't think there is one single reform. I think that... you have to start asking the questions, in what way can the Shannon add value? in what way can it be different to the Dáil and do things the Dáil doesn't do? I think that's a much more fundamental question for the Seanad.
But it is an important pretext, though, as well, that it would be different. I know there's a Seanad Reform group who contacted all the Seanad candidates during the recent Seanad general election in March, asking them to sign up to a series of reforms, one of which was that there would be universal suffrage to all the seats into the Seanad. Is there a danger, or what do you see the danger is, of having a body in the Seanad that is too similar to the Dáil?
Well, there's a question of relevance. Why? You know, and every expense now, every public expense is queried, and the media is very hostile, and, you know, there's a lot of unfair criticism, but then you'll always get somebody who will abuse the system, which brings down the wrath of the public on everybody involved, people who are obeying the rules properly. But that's a bit of a diversion. It's not easy. I mean, all of the reports, if you go back to Mary O'Rourke and others, they're all looking for ways in which the Seanad can be different. And it has done some very good things. I mean, the holding hearings, inviting in people on issues pre-legislation or issues that need legislation, that's important. But it also depends for its success on enough senators actually doing the work. And in my time, very few senators were actually genuinely interested in legislation and in doing the work. You know, they constantly, I'd be told as leader, you know, I have to be down in the constituency, I have to be in the constituency, and party headquarters say I must be there.
And do you mind if I ask you about that? I'm sorry, I'll come back to you in a second, Malcolm. But isn't that one of the great criticisms that's always made of the Seanad, is that it's either a retirement home for people who lost their seat or a stepping stone for politicians who are looking to get into the Dáil? And I say that as somebody who falls into one of those categories, I hope, and I think you do too, Malcolm. Do you think that...
I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't see anything wrong at all. I think it's a good thing if people who want to be in the Dáil ultimately spend time in the Seanad. It's a great training ground and they can do a lot. Likewise, if somebody is beaten in an election but wants to continue a political career, I think it's if they have an opportunity. I mean, a lot depends on their performance and their attitude. And I think it's far too easy a criticism to make. It's a very lazy criticism and it misses the point as far as I can see.
Malcolm, do you want to address that? Because you arguably fall into both of those categories, don't you?
One thing I would say, and I would agree with Morrison on this, part of it is around, you know, the purpose of the Seanad and how it functions. And I found since being elected, I've sat in on Seanad debates and listened to the quality of the debate. And it's because in many ways, you have people who are in the Seanad who have particular expertise in certain areas. The debate can be a lot more engaging. The Seanad tends to be less polarized and less adversarial than the Dáil, which I think is a good thing. I certainly think more can be done with the Seanad, and Morris is right. I mean, there have been reforms in terms of how it has operated and functioned. And I think when you see, you know, imaginative moves, like for instance, when the Taoiseach was making his nominees to the Seanad this time, and it was agreed among the leaders of the Taoiseach, the leader of Fine Gael and the Green Party, that one of the nominees would be for the first time a representative of the travelling community. Mm-hmm. In the past, you know, we have people who have been representatives of the unionist tradition. There is the story back in 1987 when Charlie Hoy appointed a number of non-political senators, including Brian Friel, who then voted against him at the very first opportunity.
And De Kenny did that as well. And I think a lot of the people he appointed, in fact, almost all of them, I think, were not party political people. And some of them turned out to be very good contributors to the Seanad. Would you agree with that?
Some of them did, and others absolutely useless.
Well, that's the nature of politics.
But I remember Professor Joe Lee, when he came into the Seanad, and after a short while, he said to me, "Look," he said, "I've come from an academic community background, and I came in here expecting to look down on some of these people, the level of debate is far higher than it is in the Academic Council in UCC. And he was right, because, I mean, the county councillors there, something, they knew local government inside out. They knew how legislation affected people in their locality. They knew the effects of all of that. And they were judging the legislation by the consequences on the people it's intended for. And they made it, they were hugely important in the common sense they injected in, into. I mean, it was some of the other people who came in with, around whom maybe they themselves invested very high hopes of what they were going to do, who didn't adapt to it at all, who didn't have the collegiate sense and didn't have the patience to wait around long debates and do their homework and so on. I mean, come in at the order of business, grandstand, and then head off back down. I won't say to the law library, Barry, but or to wherever it was. Anyway, sorry, I'm talking too much.
Well, I think that's another criticism made in terms of the Taoiseach's nominees, since we touch on that. I know myself, and I was little more than a student really in 2003 when I contributed to Mary O'Rourke's review, but I do remember coming into the Shannon Chamber to address her group. And one of the things I remember saying was that the 11 Taoiseach's nominees are the most undemocratic institution in Irish politics. I say that now, and I'm sitting beside some of those people in the Shannon, and they are great senators. In fact, the current leader of the Shannon is a Taoiseach's nominee. So there is potential there for the Taoiseach to appoint really good people in. But is it fair to say, and maybe Malcolm, you might answer this, given that your leader obviously appointed them this time round, there's no thanks politically for appointing somebody who isn't a member of your party, or for choosing that person from outside politics and putting them in? And certainly when Enda Kenny did it, even though he was affecting the power that the government had in the Shannon, he got no political thanks for it other than the headlines the next day.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I suppose that, you know, every time, and it can apply to the Shannon, there's anything else, when a Taoiseach or a party leader makes an appointment, you might please one person and disappoint 20 others. So, you know, there'll obviously be party tension around some of the appointments that are there. I mean, I have to say, Barry, and I mean, you know, honest with this, I've enjoyed listening to the quality of some of the debate in the Shannon. And I'd say to people who are maybe cynical, you know, come and sit and listen to some of the discussion. It's not that you always agree with what people are saying. I mean, I found myself sitting in the chamber, listening to a view being articulated, that's made me pause for thought and kind of think, well, I don't actually, he or she may be correct in that. I think Morris is also right in what he says about, you know, the county councillors and being in touch with people on the ground. One of the challenges often with legislation that is designed by very well-meaning public servants and civil servants is that they understand, you know, the law, they understand how it may be argued down at the forecourts, but in terms of the direct and practical impact, they're not always completely in touch. Whereas if you are, you know, a councillor meeting people on a daily basis, or even if you're a TD or a senator holding clinics, you know exactly how a piece of legislation or regulation impacts. And frequently, I mean, one of the things that you know, if you've good political antenna, as you'll know, if you have a number of people coming to you about the same issue, very quickly you can realize, folks, there is a problem here. And no matter how often a public servant or a minister who may be captured by their public servants tells you, no, this is the case. If you have very practical examples, you're going to be able to come back and say, no, this is not working.
Well, both Malcolm, both you and Morris served as both TDs and senators. There is a complaint but do you feel, I mean, in terms of obviously that one of the other things people talk about in terms of the Shannon's capacity is that it is very much second in line to the Dáil and is constitutionally the younger child in the family. Do you feel it still has the capacity to deliver for the people? The Shannon, I mean.
Well, I think it's totally right that it should be number two. I mean, that's what it's designed to be. And again, I use the phrase add value, do things the Dáil can't do or doesn't do. Now, the committee system, to a certain extent, has taken away from the potential of the Seanad to do something different, because the committees do call in people, do different things, and that's what makes the problem different. I don't know. There's no magic thing there. There are lots of good ideas around. But I think what keeps the Seanad in the headlines is when there are good performances in there and people are talking sense. But the biggest problem you have is the lack of any interest from the media. And that is the biggest problem. You can do sterling work there and nobody knows about it. You get no thanks for it and so on. And I mean, the media would be very quick. I don't know, is there any journalist dedicated to covering the Seanad at the moment?
I think the parliamentary reporters do cover it, in fairness, more so than the political correspondents. Yeah. But
we were hammering the Irish Times.
Yeah.
The Irish Times do something, but the Independent doesn't, certainly. It doesn't have any dedicated correspondent. RTE doesn't. So it's a problem. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you can make news yourself. I mean, we got most coverage in my time when Sean Doherty put the advice he got from the Attorney General in his back pocket and never told the rest of us. That got a bit of coverage, but that's not the sort of thing you want to be getting coverage for. So,
yeah. Malcolm, how do you feel about that kind of second-class nature of the Seanad over relative to the Dáil?
Well, it's correct that it should be. And as Maurice mentioned earlier, I mean, De Valera wanted to circumscribe its powers. As you know, when it comes to money bills or anything to do with impact on finance, the role of the Seanad is very, very limited. You'll know, Barry, yourself, when the budget, for those who are listening, when the budget passed recently, there was obviously a lot of discussion in the Dáil about it. We were simply allowed to make a few statements in the Seanad chamber. So the role is limited there, but that is correct, because it is not a directly elected chamber, the chamber of the people. I think the role, if you look at of similar senates or upper houses in a lot of bicameral systems, it does have that role. It's more an advisory role. It's to give a very different perspective to legislation and to consider it in a different way to...
Well, that's an interesting, because it's certainly something I've noticed as a new senator, is how jealously the Seanadóirí themselves guard that kind of revisionary role that we have in legislation. Like, senators very much see it as their role to take on legislation that's already gone through the Dáil in many instances and spot the things that have been missed and discuss it in a different environment with a different perspective.
That's welcome.
Yeah, and Maurice, would you agree that that was the case when you were in the Seanad?
Yeah, quite a small number of people were very good at it, but they would, and they would be listened to. And ministers would come in, and they're under less pressure when they come into the Seanad. Now, sometimes they're in a hurry. They want to get out, they want to be, that's it. They don't, but if they realise there are people there who know what they're talking about, in my time, they tended to stay. And you could always know a good minister. A good minister was one who had the confidence to see a good point being made, which his civil servants didn't want it. The minister would listen to what the senator was saying and very often act on it, or at least come back later and explain why. So at least there was a full explanation. And some ministers aren't up to it. You know, junior ministers, especially, they come in, they have a script, they rush through it, they want to get out as quickly as they can. Mm-hmm. And they're, sometimes it's the civil servants who are driving them, because civil servants tend to have a low view of the uses of a parliament. They want to get through as quickly as they can. Not all, by a long shot.
Yeah. Malcolm, can I finish by asking you, I asked Maurice this earlier, if there was one reform you could make to the Seanad, what would it be?
I think certainly we do need to look at broadening the franchise and about, you know, engaging more people to be able to contribute toward that that exercise. I agree with Maurice that the Seanad should not be a smaller replica of the Dáil. I think then there's no point in having the chamber. But I think if the Seanad can be used with its function that it is a chamber of review to bring a level of expertise to the discussion of legislation and policy. If we can further enhance that, because I think it does have that role at present, and if that means changing the structures, it would be welcome. I think there have been some reforms. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have significantly more women in the current Seanad is a sign of progress. It's a much more diverse body, arguably, even than the old chamber. But I think, you know, there are a lot of individuals who are in that chamber, including yourself, Barry, who have an expertise and a view in particular areas. And it's always important to listen to that. I think a challenge for us in politics generally is the fact that politics is becoming more polarized. That it's always about you have to take either the, you know, position A or position B. I think that if the chamber can serve to try to be more reflective, to bring people more together, I think then that represents the real Seanad reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And Maurice, finally, do you have any hope that one or both of these bills will be able to achieve any of that?
I do. I think we're in a time in politics where old certainties have broken down and there are a lot of new alliances and so on. And I think that, you know, if the pressure keeps up on government, Micheál Martin is more sympathetic than Leo Varadkar. Sinn Féin, they have a different idea and they're not the easiest people to work with because you're never quite sure what their real objective is. But there is they have expressed interest in reform. Now, I think they would want to abolish the Seanad altogether, for which you would need a referendum, and, you know, that's the problem. I mean, if it was that simple to start afresh, it would have been done, but it isn't. The Seanad, with its present constitutional constraints, is there, and everything has to happen within that, unless there's another referendum, and I don't think there's any great appetite for that.
No, well, speaking personally, let's hope that there isn't.
But I am confident, I am hopeful that there will be changes.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Dr. Maurice Manning, Chancellor of the National University of Ireland, former leader of the Seanad and long-term senator, thanks very much for taking the time to join us. And Malcolm Byrne, senator and former TD for Fianna Fáil in Wexford and sponsor of the Seanad Electoral University Members Amendment Bill 2020. Thank you for joining us as well. Very grateful for your time, and it adds hugely to the podcast. Do join us next week when we'll have another episode dealing with a piece of legislation that's going through the Oireachtas. For the meantime, this is the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. Thanks for signing in. Do subscribe and do promote us if you can. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Irish Legislation Podcast with me, Barry Ward. You can get me on Twitter at Barry M. Ward. Don't forget to subscribe and you won't miss any of the episodes as they come up on a weekly basis while the Oireachtas is sitting.